Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now is Anthony Scaramucci, founder of Skybridge Capital, who joins us as an economics advisor to the Trump campaign and author of a new book called Hopping Over the Rabbit Hole, How Entrepreneurs Turn Failure into Success. Mr. Scaramucci, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Brian, thanks so much for having me. You got to call me Anthony, though. I think of my dad as Mr. Scaramucci, but I appreciate that.
Okay.
And we'll thanks so much for having me.
And we'll get to politics a little bit later, but to get some background on you, for our listeners, you referred to Skybridge as a global alternative investment firm, and I see you run an alternatives conference seen as a prominent event in the alternative investment community. What does alternative investment mean?
Well, it's a class of investing that's different from plain vanilla stock and bond investing. And so typically a person would have in their portfolio, depending on their age and what their risk tolerance is, they'd have a collection of stocks and bonds. And then they would possibly have some real estate investing. And then the genre that we're in, the world of alternatives, is basically hedge fund investing, which is a non-correlated asset to these other products. So the hedge fund industry should be doing differently than the typical direction of stocks and bonds. And so for us, we're typically 5 to 15 cents on the dollar of an investor's portfolio. So it's a small piece. But if we're doing our jobs well, Brian, what ends up happening is we help our clients get to their actuarial goals in terms of what their total return is, by taking a little bit less risk and a little bit less volatility. And so that's as simple of an explanation as I can give you.
Thanks. On turning failure into success, the theme of your book, I see you were named the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year in 2011 after reinventing your business following the financial crisis. Can you tell us a little bit about what kind of business were you doing in 2007, 2008? Was it the same thing that you just described and how the financial crisis affected it?
Yes. And so just briefly, I was actually in the hedge fund seeding business in 2007 and into 2008. And so I'll describe that to your listener. So you would give us money as an investor. We would go out and find you hedge fund managers that you would end up owning a stake in. So in addition to having your money run by the hedge fund manager, you actually got a piece of their fee stream as a result of being their starter capital or early stage capital. And so it was a very popular business in 2005, 6, and 7. We were doing quite well. And then the earthquake hit at the end of 2007 and into the 2008 global financial crisis. Unfortunately for us, we lost 25% of the net asset value in that fund. Now, the markets went down 50. So some could say, hey, that was pretty good relative to the markets. But for me, it was very, very painful. And our assets started to shrink, Brian, from $450 million to a low point of about $200 million. And so what I write in Hopping Over the Rabbit Hole, I really try to lay out for people an honest, unsanitized story. If you had said to me in 2008, oh, don't worry about this, sometime late 2011, you'll be named the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year, I would have said, you know, what crack pipe are you smoking from? And so for us, we had a declining business. It was filled with a lot of self-consciousness, a lot of terror, anxiety. It certainly had its share of what are we going to do next? You know, and by the way, I write very honestly about this in the book. There's status consciousness that goes on as well. Like, am I going to be able to keep my country club membership even? That sort of thing. And that probably sounds elitist to people, but you know, I grew up in a blue collar family. Neither one of my parents went to college. And, you know, my dream in life was always to have my own business. And so I tried to write in Hopping Over the Rabbit Hole, here are the pluses and minuses of owning your own business. Here's something catastrophic that happened to us. And because of some positive things that we did, we were able to avoid the disaster scenario of bankruptcy or falling into the rabbit hole. We were able to hop over it. And I try to write it as a guidebook for people about resiliency, persistence, creativity, but also make it very honest so that if a young person opens it up and reads it, they'll say, wow, you know, entrepreneurship is probably very glamorized by the media or magazines, and those are typically the success stories. But even those stories have a little bit of a jagged move upward. I don't think anybody, Brian, goes up at a 45-degree slope unless they're the ones fibbing about their lives.
Before we get to your role as a Trump advisor, I see you have nice blurbs on the book from liberals as well as conservatives, Mark Cuban and Arianna Huffington. Cuban wrote, "The most valuable thing Anthony Scaramucci teaches us about success is how important, even necessary, failure is. As he shows, we all face setbacks, but it's how we learn from them that governs whether we ultimately succeed or fail." Does this suggest that you think too many entrepreneurs fold their tents too quickly after setbacks?
Maybe that happens. I mean, none of us really like pain, and certainly a lot of people will not go into entrepreneurship because of that fear of failure. I would think, you know, Mark and I have had many conversations about this, and obviously he's seen a gajillion business plans through the Shark Tank situation. But typically it's that next step. It's that, okay, let me see if I can stay in here, hang in there. I can't tell you the number of people that came to my office, former colleagues from Goldman or even colleagues from Lehman Brothers. And the irony is Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, that said to me, "Hey, time to fold up the tent. You're not doing well. You could get another job somewhere or you could have another opportunity." So, yes, I do think that if you're an entrepreneur, you have to have a very stiff backbone and you have to be ready to take the heat in these circumstances. But you mentioned the bipartisan element of it, and that's something, even though I'm a Republican and been a lifelong Republican, I like to view myself as a person that's willing to debate policy but not attack individuals or people. So, you know, I don't spend my time ad hominem attacking anybody, result of which I'm able to get at our conference guys like Joe Messina, who ran President Obama's campaign, or Donna Brazile, who just became the DNC chair after Debbie Wasserman Schultz was removed. She was at our conference last year. Mark Cuban was there. But then I also get the Republicans to come as well, including guys like Karl Rove or Margaret Hoover. And so for me, I like making these things be an ideas exposition. And I think that the fact that we have Bridge in our name, the name SkyBridge Capital, I really mean that. I want to be a bridge to both sides, even though I have an ideological view and I'm happy to share it with you and your listeners. I think it's important for us to have the active discourse. And I tell people I'm a patriot first and a partisan second.
So let's talk about some of that. Since you never know who's on the bus or off the bus these days deciding they've had enough of Donald Trump, I take it from that last answer that you're still on the bus.
Oh, yeah, no question. I mean, you have to understand the neighborhood I grew up in, you know, the hallmark of that neighborhood was loyalty. I'm loyal to the party. I also, even though I wasn't a presidential candidate, I took the pledge seriously. And I'll tell your listeners, candidly, I was with Governor Walker in the beginning. I was national finance chair. When Governor Walker came out of the race, I was with Governor Bush, who was a friend, and I knew the governor well. I also host a show, Wall Street Week, on the Fox Business Network, and I had Governor Bush on last December. So I have an enormous amount of respect for him. But when it became clear that Mr. Trump was going to be the nominee of our party, as I said to Mr. Trump, you know, you were the people's choice of the party. That's good enough for me. I'm here to help you. Tell me how I can help. And so I didn't want to be one of those people in the Never Trump movement or creating a fissure or split in the party. So that was you know, very big for me.
So general loyalty. But businesses generally don't like his isolationism and closing the borders more to capital, especially people who work in a capital-intensive business like you do. You don't think Clinton would be better for international investors like yourself and your colleagues?
You know, I think Clinton – well, Secretary Clinton, let me phrase it that way. I want to be very respectful of her. I think that she would – she would continue the course that we're on right now, which is frankly very, very good for people like myself and very good for large corporations. But the data suggests that it has not been great for the middle class or for the working class families in our society. Because if you look at the data over the last 10 years, real wages for the middle class are down about 9.1%. Working class people now, unfortunately, there's 47.1 million Americans that are on some level of governmental dependency. And, you know, I've been on the campaign trail with Mr. Trump, attended many of his rallies. I can tell you these people do not want to be on governmental dependency, but they're having a hard time finding jobs and finding opportunity. And you mentioned something about the protectionism and that sort of thing. I think we haven't done the best job of explaining the policies, because there's nothing in his agenda. If you go to DonaldJTrump.com, that's protectionist. All he is suggesting is that he wants these trade deals to be fairer to the United States. And you know, I have gotten the luxury, or not the luxury, it's actually almost like a homework assignment. I've actually read through most of these trade deals, Brian. And just quickly for your listeners, since 1946 to today, 70 years, the State Department and the Treasury put together these trade deals so that they would be unbalanced to the United States. So goods and services could flow freely into the U.S., but our goods and services were embargoed to protect working class people in the emerging economies. And by the way, I think that was a very, very good strategy. It originated with Dean Atkinson and George Marshall in the Truman administration, and they made a bipartisan commitment to that over the last 70 years. You can see that in the design of TPP. You can see it in the design of NAFTA, and also the acceptance of China into the World Trade Organization.
But let me jump in, because what you're alleging there, I think, is that over many generations, across political parties, the U.S. government has negotiated trade deals specifically with the intent to benefit emerging countries more than benefit the United States.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I'm actually not alleging that, sir. That's actually factual. You can go to the trade deals, or you can talk to the people that work in the State Department or Treasury, and you can ask them about that, and you can actually look at the agreements.
Why would the U.S. do that? I mean, Donald Trump isn't the first person to say that as president he would act in the interest of the United States. You know, every elected official says that.
Well, I think that was absolutely in the interest of the United States. I think that there were many things going on during that period of time where that made sense. We were fighting the Cold War. We were trying to reject communism in areas of the world. And so we thought that we needed to develop the world's emerging middle class in order to ensure that the world didn't fall into the hemisphere of communism.
I think NAFTA was post-communism, 1994, and just with Canada and Mexico, which were not in that conflict.
Oh, yeah. And so the State Department and Treasury would say that about NAFTA, and even Al Gore, when he was in that famous debate with Ross Perot on CNN, I don't know if you remember that, but he even said the same thing, that it's important for the United States, particularly in its southern border, to help the Mexican economy grow and to create a burgeoning middle class for Mexico. What Ross Perot said is that may be true, but you'll see a great sucking sound of our jobs coming out of the United States. One of the byproducts, Brian, of this, the policy, by the way, many benefits of that policy. I'm really trying to be as accurate and as fair as I can. If you go back through the history of the decisions on these trade deals, it has made the world safer. It has made the world more peaceful. And when nations are more economically interdependent, we're going to do better as a global society and as the United States. However, one of the negative byproducts is that we've lost some of our middle class jobs, and real wages for the middle class and the working class have been impacted by these deals. And so all Mr. Trump is saying is, and he says it differently than me, but I'll explain it to you. He just wants to even out the deals now after 71 years of them being uneven. He would like to even them out. And so he's for free, fair trade. Where the imposition of tariffs and that sort of stuff would only come in is the extent that people did not want to. And you know this, perhaps you, I'm sure you know this, that NAFTA has a 24-month review process in it. It's been law of the land for 24 years. It's never once been reviewed. And so each party of NAFTA has the opportunity to say, okay, this is slightly unfair to me, or this has been more beneficial to you. Let's right-size this deal to make it fair for each other.
Do you honestly believe, though, that this would bring any meaningful number of manufacturing jobs back to America? Trump always says, bring the manufacturing jobs back to America. But I don't know any economist who believes that manufacturing jobs that have fled, or the kinds of manufacturing jobs that the people who are in his base, who might have had no college education and were still able to get middle-class jobs because of manufacturing in the old days, are going to be satisfied by what the results are.
Yeah, and listen, and that's an interesting – and that's obviously the conventional view for many economists. And one of the reasons why there's a lot of entrepreneurs on Mr. Trump's economic advisory council is that entrepreneurs think very, very differently than that. And so with the right tax and regulation policies and the right incentives to bring back manufacturing, which is effectively to lower the per unit marginal cost for these producers, which would incentivize them to return to the United States. Under the conventional economists, absolutely not. That's status quo. It's the same reason why conventional economists say that the tax cut that he's proposing would add $5 trillion to the deficit, but they're positioning that with absolutely no growth in the economy. And so if you assume that the economy doesn't grow after that tax cut, well, certainly it would add a lot of money to the deficit.
And that's what Mr. Trump says in the debates. But how much growth do you think is realistic? I realize we're having 1%, 2% growth, which is historically low, but I don't think there are many economists out there who think that Trump isn't just blowing smoke when he says we're going to have 5% growth, 6% growth.
Well, you see, again, and this is I think what the election is going to come down to. There is a status quo argument and there's a conventional theory argument. And there's even an argument that we're so big now, $17, $18 trillion GDP, that the law of large averages or stuff that we can't grow it faster than that. And so that's the status quo argument. That's more of a corporate argument. The entrepreneur's argument would be, you know, we're the most dynamic, most innovative country in the history of the world. We have the best legal system in terms of intellectual property rights in the world. We can draw upon. Remember, Mr. Trump wants, and this is an ironic thing because the media doesn't really discuss this, and he has said it many times, he wants waves and waves of immigration. He just wants the immigration to be legal, and he wants the laws that were passed by the Congress and signed by two presidents in a bipartisan fashion, those immigration laws, he wants them to be enforced. That's all he's saying.
But to finish the thought on the manufacturing jobs.
But just to finish the thought,
go ahead.
You get the right tax policies in place and you get the right manufacturing incentives and you work on a reconciliation of the tax treaties and get half of the money, the several trillion dollars that's off the shore of the United States repatriated, and you work on that systematically on behalf of the American people, this economy could grow at 3.5 to 4%. I reject the notion from Larry Summers and others about secular stagnation. If you've got $1.3 billion in China growing at 6 or 7%, the 323 million people in the United States with the right policies and the right incentives can grow faster than China. And so can we get to 3-4%? I obviously believe that we can. I've looked at the simulation models in different scenarios, and I believe that we can get there. And so to me, the only way you're going to improve the standards of living for the working class and for the middle class is by creating that growth. And Brian, I just want to say one last thing, and I promise to stop. I grew up in an aspirational working class family. And that meant that my dad had a lunch pail and we came home at 5:15. And if I didn't have sports, I had to be at that table at 5:15. His deal was go to school, work super hard, and you'll be a member of the upper class at some point in your life. That's the dream that Americans have. The working class today, they don't have that dream, sir. Many of those people feel hopeless for the next generation of their children. And we're a better country than that. We can come up with policies and ideas and innovations that can help those people. So I reject the secular stagnation thesis.
But let me follow up on exactly that assertion, because people with little education, what jobs are going to come back for them? Again, this bringing manufacturing jobs back. Is the clothing industry, the textile industry coming back? Are we going to have our clothes made here again? Are televisions coming back to be made in the United States? Mr. Trump talks about boycotting Oreos because Nabisco moved a factory to Mexico. Is that coming back to the United States? Or is a better way to go to focus on what the Clinton people have now embraced from Bernie Sanders, which is free public college for 80% of the population based on income, to get more and more and more people educated for the export-related manufacturing jobs that are the jobs of the future?
Okay, so let me just stop you right there with the notion of free. And so this is an interesting notion because there is no such thing as free.
She wants to tax you for it, to be perfectly honest, right? Because she's talking about paying for it with a tax on the upper couple of percent, and Mr. Trump wants to lower taxes.
Okay, but do the math, sir.
On the upper 1%.
She could take 100% of my life's work, and she could take 100% of the top 2% of the population's life work, and she still will not be able to pay for all these programs. I mean, it's just at the end of the day, what the left fails to recognize is that taxation is actually a price for services. And so if you are under-delivering and underperforming on the services, whether what's going on in the inner cities, broadly in the educational industry in the United States, what's going on in terms of the healthcare legislation and for small businesses, where it's absolutely crippling these small businesses, if you just look through the myriad of different things, when someone says the word free – you have to know, I'm sure you're old enough to know, that there's no such thing as free. And so it's going to come from somebody. And then when it comes from somebody, you're going to incentivize those people to do different things. As an example, the third largest city in France now is London. And the reason it's London is that they're all migrating to the United Kingdom to avoid the excessively high taxes in the country of France.
But to a lot of our listeners, that's going to sound like an excuse for the status quo, which is the concentration of wealth that has galloped ahead over the last few decades. So let me finish the question.
No, but sir, not an excuse at all. If you want to close the income divide, you have to create opportunity for small businesses to be incentivized to hire people. And you've got to create an opportunity for businesses large and small to retrain a lot of these uneducated workers, like the stuff that showed up on 60 Minutes over the weekend. And so there's no excuse here. Listen, I've studied this stuff. I'm ready to debate it. I've looked at it very, very carefully.
But people would have to
– this isn't left or right for me. It's right or wrong.
But
it's
people
like,
would
what
have
are the
to
policies that work?
Accept that traditional trickle-down economics, which is what I think Mr. Trump is increasingly embracing and what you're articulating here, works to distribute income fairly, and that's what many would argue we've seen not work over the last few decades.
Okay, but Brian, when you say trickle-down economics, and this is an interesting thing about the left, it's an emotionally charged thing. Okay, when you say that the rich have to quote-unquote pay their fair share, when the top 5% of the wealthy are paying 71% of the taxes, and you say, well, that's not enough, they've got to pay their fair share. Okay, those are emotionally charged ways of describing something, and it can get somebody that's not in that class say, okay, yeah, let's vote for these ideas. They're emotionally charged, and let's do it. But what you find is it doesn't work. During the Obama administration, over the last 8 years, the poor and the middle class have not done well. In fact, what the president has done for the wealthy has been absolutely staggering, because the zero interest rate policy, which hollows out the savings ability of the middle class, has been enormously beneficial to the class of people that have assets.
Well, that's not the president. That's the Fed. But would you argue for higher interest rates?
But it is the president, sir. Come on. You have to be honest about this stuff. The if you read Dr. Bernanke's memoirs or you look at the Beige Book from Chairwoman Yellen,
Bush appointed,
what you discover
Bernanke
from both of them is that the fiscal policies of the United States have not been there to help the Fed. And so the Fed is forced into a box where they jam the interest rates down to zero. But you haven't reformed the tax code. You haven't you had one stimulus of $800 billion that effectively created no growth. There's been no long-term infrastructure plan for the United States. And by the way,
I'm here to indict both parties.
I'm not here to pick on the president. I would make the indictment of the political establishment on that.
As I understand Bernanke's memoir and the Fed in general, what they were frustrated with the policy sector for was for not stimulating enough, and therefore they felt they had to do the heavy lift because the Republican Congress wouldn't do it. And therefore, they were compensating with the 0% interest rates. Is that not your understanding?
Okay. So I'm ascribing 50% blame to each party, and you want to ascribe the blame 100% to the Republicans. I don't accept that. There were three or four things on the table in July of 2011 – under the grand bargain in negotiation, where Boehner will tell you and Cantor would tell you that the president balked on the same way that they balked on it. And so to me, it's an indictment of both sides. And I think that's where the frustration has been expressed in the American people, whether it's the Bernie Sanders movement or the Donald J. Trump movement. They feel that the people in Washington, Republican or Democrat, are not doing the job that the American people would like them to do, which is to come up with the right policies. Forget about whether they're generated from the left or the right. What are the right policies that will help the most amount of the American people? And so you and I probably intellectually disagree on this, but I've studied it very carefully. Left-leaning policies are phenomenal for me. But what they do is they stultify the middle class and they crush the working poor. And that's typically what's happened in every country that's implemented left-leaning policies. These labor regulations that have been put in by the Obama administration are stopping small businesses from hiring the incremental employee. And do you know why, Brian? Because they can't fire the incremental employee. The country that can fire the most people will always hire the most people. You can't get hired in France because it takes you 3 years to fire the person if they're not doing well. That's why there's 25% unemployment in France.
We're just about out of time. But if Trump wins, are you our next Treasury Secretary?
I'm not, sir. No, I love my business. I think if you read Hopping Over the Rabbit Hole, you'll know that my calling in life is to be an entrepreneur and to try to create new businesses and new ideas. And I'm very proud of the fact that I've got 85 people working here at SkyBridge, and SkyBridge pays 100% of their healthcare expenses. We don't take one payroll deduction from anybody, and our healthcare premiums have gone up about 85% per year in the last 3 years. And so for me, I've got a big obligation to my 37,000 clients. I love my 85, the people that work with me. You'll learn in my book, no one's ever worked for me, sir. People work with me. This is a collaboration over here at SkyBridge, and I'm very, very excited to go forward over the next 10 years doing it. But I recognize as an American citizen that we have a big problem in the country. I don't want to live in a barbed-wired compound in a McMansion with security. I want my neighbors to do a lot better than they're doing right now. And we've got to stop the nonsense politically and all the jargon and talking points and just come up with the right policies here to help the most amount of American people. And so you tell me where they come from, Brian. I'm ready to go to work on them.
Anthony Scaramucci, founder of SkyBridge Capital, also an economics advisor to the Trump campaign and author of the new book called Hopping Over the Rabbit Hole, How Entrepreneurs Turn Failure into Success. It was good to talk policy with you when most of cable television is focusing on anything but 24/7. Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, same here, sir. Thank you for the opportunity.